Hello there, and welcome to the AFA podcast, the official podcast of animationforadults.com, and Happy New Year! I'm Chris, and today we are bringing you a very special episode of the podcast. It is our best of 2016 episode, featuring some of our best moments from the year's podcasts, including some of our guest appearances and some extra stuff as well. You can find all our previous episodes on animationforadults.com, on iTunes, on Stitcher, and on podcast.com. And you might notice that the sound quality varies from section to section because we did have quite a few issues over the course of the year when we were recording episodes, but we have found a more reliable method that we hope to use going forward. Unfortunately, it's not free, so if you would like to help support us producing more episodes in future, then you might like to consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/animationforadults, or even sending us a one-off donation through PayPal, and you can find all the details in the show notes. So we hope you enjoy the show, and we will see you very soon for episode 65.
Today we have a special guest on the podcast today. Our special guest today, David Lally. He is an animator for Pixar. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. I'm more of a technical animator than an actual like character animator by trade, but we can get into all that in a bit.
Yeah, definitely. And just to kind of kick things off, like you said, David, just wanted to actually ask you, when did you start working for Pixar?
I started with Pixar back in, it was about 2010, in the summertime, and my first movie was Cars 2, and I actually came on to do some crowds work, but since then I kind of shifted over, and now I do a lot more work with things like secondary character elements, like cloth and costumes and hair and props and things like that.
Nice.
Very cool.
And I think a lot of our listeners will be wanting to know, how did you get a job at Pixar then?
Yeah, I know. It's actually pretty crazy. Pixar, at least in the States and otherwise, I think has like pretty targeted schools that they recruit from. And my school at the time wasn't one of those schools. So I actually had to kind of sneak over to the school nearby that they did recruit from and get my demo reel kind of ushered into the guy. And he actually saw it and was super supportive. And it just turns out that they were trying to work on two movies at the time, which were Cars 2 and Brave. And they both had significant numbers of crowd characters that they needed help kind of technically animating. So I was able to kind of sneak my way in there and kind of get my foot in the door doing that for Cars. And then since then, kind of have been doing everything from Brave and Monsters University, Inside Out and A Good Dinosaur, and some others. And Finding Dory most recently, which I just finished up on last week.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, so, it's been a hell of a ride.
So did you go straight from uni straight into Pixar?
I did, yeah. I did my undergrad, and then I went to grad school at Drexel University, and I studied animation and visual effects, and then more of a all-encompassing digital media slash new media type of degree, which was like a game design, web design, and animation all kind of lumped into one. And then, yeah, right out of grad school, I kind of went out and got this position at Pixar. So
living the dream.
It's a little too convenient. Yeah. I feel like at any day now, I'm just going to like wake up from a dream or something. Yeah.
So what is it like going working, especially since you worked on so many, you said smaller projects and even the bigger feature films. So what's that been like?
It's been awesome. It's been interesting coming from school. And as you guys probably know, working on shorter form projects with like super small teams, and then kind of just getting thrown into this like bigger system of animation creation, which kind of requires everyone to be a little bit more specialized in a thing. So I feel like I can do a lot, but I really only get to do like one or maybe two things per movie. So I like that I can kind of jump around and get to do things like crowds or do hair simulation on one show, or one of the movies that Lee Unkrich is working on, Coco, is coming up, and that like looks like it has potential to have some really nice costumes and things like that. So there's lots to look forward to in terms of cloth and hair effects and things like that, which get me really excited about the films.
Very That's cool. Awesome.
Yeah.
So everyone sort of imagines that Pixar is basically like either Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, or has anyone seen the Robin Williams movie Toys? They sort of, that's what your life's like. That's what they imagine.
Yeah, it's exactly like that.
Yeah, just everyone riding around on scooters, having fun, and
I knew there's a cereal bar.
Yeah, there's a cereal bar. The campus is actually pretty awesome. I think after you're there for even 5 years, 6 years, like I've been there now, you start to take it for granted a little bit, and we need to be reminded how awesome it actually is. But yeah, we're super privileged, and I think it is still one of the best animation companies to work for, as I've had a number of friends kind of come over from different other studios like Sony or DreamWorks, and they seem to really like Pixar a lot, and the culture that we try to maintain and keep it pretty like employee and artist centric. I think it's a rare find as a film studio to not want to treat your employees like kind of like cogs in a machine type of thing. You're just kind of like doing this thing, and people really do respect your craft and your input to every part of the film.
And also, aren't you sort of given a lot more time to work, like with regard to timeline too? Is it there? So it seems like there's more sort of time spent in all the different elements. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that comes with the territory of specializing rather than kind of being spread out among doing so many things. So you certainly have your people that are focused on, you know, just making the performance of the character animation great. And I can really focus in on supporting that with whatever type of technical elements that are required. And then we just, you know, everyone from just lighting specialists to even a rendering specialist, just making sure there's not a single, you know, glitch or artifact in any frame of the movie. We're obsessive about that type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely, I mean, the same kind of pipeline exists in other companies, though, but it seems like there's less sort of time allotted for, you know what I mean? I mean, for at least based on what I've...
Yeah, we're in a unique position where we're making our own films, so we're not, like, outward facing in terms of working with clients, like a lot of visual effects, you know? Like, so if you're working at Industrial Light and Magic or ILM and you're working on a Marvel movie... I think the live action production is usually taking up the bulk of that time, and it's probably compressing a lot of the post-production schedule. That's kind of the typical story you hear in visual effects. And then those guys are super crunched, so they may not get to spend as much time as they wanted to. It's really, you know, the release date's out there. You can't really change your release date. So it's just about getting it out the door with, you know, as good as you can make it. And they usually rock it anyway, but, yeah, it's a little bit more relaxed, and we certainly have made some tough decisions with our films. I mean, you guys may have heard the stories with The Good Dinosaur and how we weren't super confident in it at the time, so we ended up sitting on it for a little while and taking it back to all the way to the script and then kind of building it up again. So when we feel like a movie is not going as planned, we will kind of take a step back and see if we can make it great before we put it out. Which awesome. I think a lot of studios might not try to do for expense and for other reasons, but it's important to Pixar. So
it's beautiful.
Yeah.
I think it's amazing that you just said that you've just done the last shot on Finding Dory, because I'm always amazed at how soon between release dates and the film's being finished, how small the gap is, because I always think, oh, you know, you must have it done ages, but it seems like it's just like done out the door pretty much. And it's like,
yeah, I feel like, and I mean, I've only been around for 5 or 6 years at Pixar, but I do feel like that's getting a little bit tighter every time. I don't know. We're actually trying to, you know, we're doing more films a year now. So we had Inside Out and The Good Dinosaur came out together. And Disney Animation's doing a similar thing. So, you'll start kind of noticing this trend as we kind of increase the number of projects. Of course, those deadlines need to shift a little bit as well. So, but I think we have pipelines that are a little bit more robust now and tools that can kind of support that type of efficiency. So usually we can pull it off, but yeah, it was kind of down to the wire, I think. But, I think Finding Dory is looking really great. Can't wait for you guys to see it.
Beautiful.
Awesome. I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Sweet.
Yeah. So, David, how early like into like the process do you get involved? Because like I think when Yvonne was like talking about you having lots of time, like I was thinking of like looking at all the documentaries and like the art of books. Like it seems like you guys have a lot of time to develop things, and it's is that true or or like how does that work for you? At what point do you get involved with what's happening?
So I mean, pre-production on any of the films can kind of start as early as it takes about like 5 years in total to make one of these films, for if we're moving really quickly. So it's quite a bit of time, and that's everything from script to just pre-production, from the first sketches to trying to discover the characters and all that type of stuff. And that's all well before anything ends up going into 3D. Lately, I've been more of a shot artist, which means that I get to come on more like a year to a year and a half out from release, which is really just like, okay, everything's in play. Here's a lot of the design work has been done. We just need to kind of get these shots animated. However, prior to that, I've done some asset work as well, which is more like character modeling and costume modeling and things like that. So you don't have more time to actually work on that stuff. It's just that it happens earlier in the pipeline before it gets passed off to people that are going to run that all through the shot work. So typically we have people that are appointed as leads or supervisors, art directors and production designers, and all those people tend to go on really early. And I think they have a lot more kind of creative input and decide how things will be designed and influenced to like the look and feel of the movie. So I think that, yeah, by the time that stuff gets to shot work, we're more concerned with things like motion and performance, more so than like look and form and things that would be handled earlier on.
I see. Cool. And then like, what departments do you find you, what other departments do you find yourself like working with most closely?
Yeah, for simulation work or any type of like character effects work, we're working super closely with animation first and foremost. They are kind of the guys that are right before us, so they will pass off their work directly to us. Certainly, in some cases, lighting for things like Finding Dory, we did a lot of like underwater particulate effects, which look really cool and really sell the idea of like fluid moving around underwater. And in that case, we'll work with lighting to dial in the look of that and the effects team as well. Yeah, there's a lot of really great stuff to see in that movie. Lots of new lighting and rendering tricks that I think you'll be impressed to see on screen in terms of like, especially if you were to compare it to the first Finding Nemo.
Yeah, I was actually going to bring that up, and just to, because it's saying, since you're working on how much like with the new technology between when the first movie came out and with the technology you guys have now, like how much did, were there a lot of changes that had to be made in terms of, rendering that, or no?
I mean, the renderers are always capable of hitting pretty big benchmarks in terms of like photorealism. That's not always the target look of every movie, though. There's some great stuff out there regarding, Toy Story 3 and what they were capable of doing with RenderMan at the time. RenderMan is the Pixar renderer. And, looking back to the prior Toy Story film, which was Toy Story 2, and, you still have these plastic shaders that don't look super awesome, and even Andy doesn't look super great at the time. But it's, as good as we could back then. So they actually keep a lot of that in mind, and I think they make decisions that would make the movie look better. So I think, if you compare Andy in Toy Story 1 to Toy Story 3, he looks a lot better and more human. but at the same time, you want to keep Woody and Buzz and these characters that you kind of like know and love to feel familiar and not feel like suddenly they have, you can see pores in their skin or something crazy like that, right? Just because you can doesn't mean you should. So, so you want it to feel like it's still that. And I think we did a very similar thing with Finding Dory. There's a lot of like really great high fidelity visuals in there in terms of the lighting effects. But I think you'll come to see that, even from the trailers, that like Marlin and Nemo are pretty identifiable and pretty familiar in terms of their shading and the way they behave.
Definitely. Any other questions before we move on?
One of the basically, I know that the first way that David came across the podcast was because we talked about the short Borrowed Time, which I know you're involved with, and I just wondered how you came to be involved with that.
Borrowed Time's is a CG short. We have a trailer out there on Vimeo now. Maybe we could post it on the site or something, but if people haven't seen it. But yeah, you guys had mentioned it before, which is awesome, and we kind of stumbled across the podcast because of that, and we were super thrilled to have people talking about it at all after so much work. We actually worked on that. Most of us are at Pixar, and we were working on that after hours for almost 4 or 5 years.
Just
Wow.
After work. So Pixar was kind enough to let us use some of their resources and things like that. But for the most part, it was really just a lot of volunteer time from a lot of great people that were just really passionate about what we were putting down. So myself included. So I was a simulation supervisor on that. So I got to do a lot of the costumes and hair once more, coming off of, I guess I was on Brave at the time when I started working on that, which is kind of crazy to say that we actually just finished it like last year. So it took a little while, but we're very happy with it. So it's in the festival circuit right now.
That's beautiful. I'm so glad. It's so cool to hear that you guys were sort of working on independent project as well, you know. And I did actually reached out to someone via Twitter about playing Borrowed Time at Animation Nights New York. Of course.
Oh yeah. I think they're super into that. I think they're waiting to see if they can get into a New York film festival so they can like bring it around and do a lot of like New York based stuff like all in one go and actually be there. Because I think that's super, preferred for them to actually be there and see people's reactions in person and things like that.
Cool.
Yeah. It's very interesting premise. Like I only just recently saw the trailer, but it looked really, really cool. Like that, this sheriff in, like you get to see a little bit of his backstory, and it seems like it's going to be really cool, like back and forth between, you know, the present day and then the past kind of story.
Yeah, we've gotten a lot of compliments to that effect about how it feels a bit more mature in terms of its storytelling and its target audience, but it still kind of feels like the look and design and kind of production quality of what you might expect from a Pixar short film. So I think people are often very surprised by that once they actually sit down and see it in the theater. So I can't wait for you guys to see it, though, in full somehow, whether it's at Animation Nights or otherwise.
Yeah, now that... We'll have a bigger space to be able to sit on indoor grass, I think, but by then.
Hey.
But but no, that also the character design is really something. You know, it's got like we talked about this a little bit when we discussed the short film on the podcast last time. Mm-hmm. The character design has a real I don't know, it's just really beautiful. It's got kind of like it's exaggerated in all the right ways. You know what I mean? The characters like the ones that you see in the trailer.
Terrific. The directors, Andrew Coates and Lou Hamilage, are really fantastic, both modelers and animators, and they have a really good sense for both, static form and appealing shapes, and what makes a character appealing, and then also immediately how that will affect the movement of the character, and they're kind of in tune with that during the design phase as well. So I think they're a really special combination as directors, and yeah, I can't wait for you guys to talk to them a little bit more about it, so we should definitely set that up.
Totally.
Definitely. Yeah.
Wonderful. So exciting. Very excited for Moana, not just for the quality of the animation, but for sure it'll be the high quality of the songs, I'm sure. And everything, just because of the team involved on that and everything. And I know it's going to have a wide appeal because my mother wants to see it, and if my mother wants to see an animated film, that's a good thing because she's in the thought mindset that all animation is meant for kids. So she getting her to go see an animated movie is a feat in and of itself, and if she wants to go see an animated movie, it usually means it either has wide audience appeal and it's stupid, or it has wide audience appeal and it's fantastic. No, because we did a family outing to go see Minions last year. And then I went and saw Penguins of Madagascar with her.
But I would say nothing in either of those films to really probably change your mom's opinion of animation.
Maybe you should try some independent animated shorts. And the reason I say that is because just recently in the last month, I made two converts of people in their 70s. So if you're going to be set in your ways, I think 70s. Yeah, neither of them was into animation. And then after going to one screening at Animation Nights New York, they're suddenly total converts.
That's awesome.
So cool. It was amazing. I'm hearing things like, they just pull you in. They pull you in and keep you, and they're short, and
and they're just, it was incredible.
That's so funny.
Yeah, isn't that what it means? Like, they had no desire, like, they were in that mindset that, you know, animation is for kids, so.
I honestly don't know how I can remember. There's been, like, moments and stuff, like, she did go see Finding Dory, because Finding Nemo was one of her absolute favorite films. And so nice. She was like intent that we all go see Finding Dory as a family, which we did, which was fantastic. And then she sees the trailer for Moana in front of it and everything. And then after it's done, she leans over to me, she's like, I want to go see that. And I was like, oh,
nice.
Is that like, okay. So? Is that so? Then we shall go and we'll go see it. Mm. So I always get kind of excited when she wants to go see like a legit animated film that like, isn't purely just for kids and everything, like Minions and Penguins and that stuff. And then like once in a while, like when I would watch animation at home, when I still lived with my parents and stuff, she'd kind of sit and watch them. And most of the time she thought what I was watching was dumb, and it'd usually be like one of the episodes you'd have to have been like watching the series for a while to actually truly get and understand the humor. But there was one time I was watching an episode of Gravity Falls and everything, and it was the one where they time travel through time and everything to different places, and they end up in like the 1800s. And she laughs so hard when Mabel tells this pioneer woman, guess who gets to vote in 100 years, ladies up top. My mom thought that was fantastic and everything. So I'm like, so every time I'm like, see mom. Like, yeah. So, yeah.
I had one of my own moments like that in my recent vacation to California to my aunt's house. Just a real quick side note. But it was the evening, and we just had a big day at the beach, and we were all looking for something to watch while we waited for the sun to set and go stargazing. And, you know, we were trying to decide on what we wanted to watch, and I had mentioned to my aunts that I had brought some DVDs with me. And one was a TV show, and they're like, oh, we'll bring that down and we'll watch that. I'm like, are you sure? He's like, yeah, sure. And like, okay, it's an animated show, so I'm not sure how you feel about it. She's like, oh, which, they kind of paused at that, and then just like, oh, okay. And, you know, just we need something short because the Netflix isn't working, so that's the next best thing. And then I brought down Cowboy Bebop.
Nice.
And put on the first two episodes, and while they weren't too sure about the second one, which introduced the puppy dog, even though the puppy dog is awesome, they really enjoyed the very first episode, and I believe one of my aunts expressed an interest in actually looking up more of the show, and was like, I'm not sure if they have it on Netflix or anywhere streaming yet, but if they do, I will let you know. That was a big accomplishment because both of them are very kind of set in their ways, and they've also worked with kids the majority of their lives, and so that does involve watching a lot of animated children's films, and so that probably just had them like, oh, well, most animated films are kids, right? It's like, well,
it's a very
Cowboy Bebop. It's like not entirely.
Yeah, it's a very difficult mindset to try and get people out of and everything, and like I'm glad we're exploring this topic like on our 1 year podcast and everything. This is actually a really productive tangent, is like dealing with that mindset that animation is simply something for kids and everything, and isn't a medium and everything, because it's not a genre, it's a medium in and of itself, and like how do you deal with people who think like that, especially people like your parents or like close relatives or friends or something, and like how do you get them to respect the fact that you really like animation and you take it seriously
and productively work on it also.
Productively work on it too. Yeah Like when my parents found out like I write for an animation website, they're like, okay, that's nice, honey. And they don't really, my dad's more into it than my mom. He thinks it's actually kind of cool. He's read some of my articles. I don't think my mom's read any of them. My dad's more like, that's awesome. Mom's just like, okay, honey, that's nice. How's the nursing job? How's your real job? it's like dealing with that, and then like also like trying to find the time to watch
the shows that I wanted to watch without them around, so that I wasn't feeling like I was being judged on what I was watching.
Exactly.
Yeah, because like I'd be like, okay, there's new Phineas and Ferb tonight, but my parents are home, and how am I going to watch this? Mm-hmm. And everything. So, yeah, it's a very interesting dynamic and everything. And I think what people need to realize, especially those who are in that mindset, is that animation is not a genre. It's not simply purely meant for kids. It is a medium in and of itself. And if someone truly enjoys it and everything, like, listen to them and maybe have them show you something that'll change your mind and everything. There's plenty of things out there for everyone in animation. I mean, if you like bloody violence and stuff, Attack on Titan.
There you go.
If you like really like witty humor, you've got Phineas and Ferb. You've got what else? You've got Steven Universe, which is amazingly progressive.
Space Western, you have Cowboy Bebop.
Exactly. If you want great films based off of comics, you've got Flashpoint Paradox. You've got the upcoming R-rated Batman The Killing Joke. That's going to be rated R.
Yeah.
If you want to be depressed, just watch Grave of Fireflies.
Yeah, I watched that this morning. It's sort of... They tell you where you're going to go, like, in the first... Mm-hmm. Right, so 30 seconds. Yeah. So you're kind of like, all right, let me just get some coffee.
Yeah,
this is what's about to happen.
Yeah. Yep, get some coffee, put a little brandy in it too. A lot of brandy.
I'd like 8 in the morning. It's perfect. That's perfect.
What I do like, though, is like when I actually have like someone who actually takes my interest seriously and actually like legitimately is curious to learn more about animation and maybe get into it themselves. It's a great feeling and stuff, like especially if they weren't too into it themselves. I actually have a friend who I think listens to this podcast still and everything. They brought it up at our book club meeting and stuff. So if they're listening, hey, Dan. Anyways, so he's actually one of my friends who actually got fascinated in animation, and he'll actually like ask me for recommendations, which I always like and everything. And ooh. I'm pretty sure I got him into Gravity Falls.
Nice.
Which was fantastic. Phineas and Ferb, I know I got him into it. I got several people into that one. I'm sorry. and then he's really into Steven Universe right now. And yeah, it's kind of cool just watching that progression and like seeing someone else get into animation and gain an appreciation and respect for it. Like, on a similar level that I do, and being like, yeah, I had a hand in that. So, I converted someone and everything. Yeah. I don't know how he felt about animation beforehand. I don't think he was as into it as he is now and stuff, but yeah, it's really cool seeing him get into it and have this level of respect for it and stuff. And I'm like, that's awesome. So yeah, and like, yeah, not every show I recommend is like his cup of tea. Like Miraculous Ladybug wasn't his cup of tea, but I'm like, I think that show is more meant for girls anyways. it's very bubbly and very magical transformations. So I adore that show. I need more of that show.
So do I. I blame you for getting me into that show.
I'm not sorry. That's just awesome.
You shouldn't feel sorry because it's awesome and I love it.
I love Miraculous Ladybug. And I love the fact that there's a magical boy transformation in it too. Like, yeah. Apparently that happens in animes as well, but I'm like, gender equality.
It does happen in animes. Sometimes there's like, there have been whole shows that kind of like take, like, okay, we had magical girls. Now we have an entirely magical boy show. Just like, okay.
Is that? Free Swim episode or that show or whatever? The one with all the hot teenage anime boys that just swim? Free?
called Free, yes.
It's called Free, yeah.
Yes, that's what it's called. I actually haven't seen that show yet, but I'm
I haven't either.
It looks
I haven't either. It looks hilarious and ridiculous.
Yes. But, yeah, there's like, so, yeah, there's equal magical girl and magical guy transformations in equal share, yes. Because there's all, in Japan, there's an equal audience for both.
Yes, and it's fantastic because they're both equally ridiculous.
But it's good to see France is getting in on that too.
I know, that like made my day. Like I'm watching it and I'm like, they did the magical girl transformation for Ladybug and I'm like, okay, that's cool and everything and stuff. And then when we get to Adrian Quatenoir and they did a magical boy transformation for him, and I was like, oh my god. I was just beside myself because he just owns it too. So yeah, but I love it.
We are not joined by Rachel this week. Unfortunately, not unfortunately, because she's off on a holiday, so she's having fun. So, but we miss her anyway. But we are joined this week by a special guest. We are joined by Danny Abram. Hello.
Hiya. Hi.
How's it going?
Yeah, I'm really good, thank you. Thanks for having me on. I'm quite nervous, though.
You're very welcome. You're joining us to talk this week about Aardman, because it is their 40th anniversary this month.
Happy birthday.
And we thought, what a perfect time to talk about Aardman. And if you'd just like to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, cool. Okay. So my name's Danny, and I've been an animator for nearly 10 years now. Mostly CG and 2D digital animation. I've worked in across the games and the children's TV and feature film industries. I've been like quite lucky. I've been on some pretty big projects. The feature films I've worked on, Aardman's The Pirates, which I think that's why you've got me on. And I've just recently come off Mike Mort's Chuck Steele's Night of the Trampires as a compositor. So I do a little bit of everything. I've been around a bit.
That looks so good.
Oh my god, have you seen the stills and stuff they've been releasing? It's sexy.
I've seen some of them. I've seen the trailer. I've seen the trailer, yeah. And I've seen some of the in production stuff.
Yeah, it's so good looking. I cannot wait for it to be out.
Next year, isn't it?
Yeah, 2017. I think we're hoping for it. Yeah, I think production finishes, like animation production finishes in March. So sometime after that.
This now is as good time as any. I'd supposed to say, Danny, you worked at Aardman. What was that like then? How did that?
I
how
sure
did you get
did.
In?
Oh well, how did I get in? I can say that everything you would ever hope Aardman would be, it delivers and then some. Like absolutely adored my time there. I worked on the pirates in an adventure with scientists. So it wasn't really like anything that was immediately recognisable as Aardman when we first started. When I got my interview, I got told to read the books by an author called Gideon Defoe. And so then that was when my first clue that it wasn't kind of... It was a new IP, is what I'm getting at. So I went off and read the books and stuff, and the books are really, really funny. If you ever get a chance to read them, I totally recommend them.
I've read the first one.
Oh, really? It's so like, funny. I absolutely love them.
I had read it before they announced the film, and
I
read it and thought this would be a great film, and it should have Brian Blessed in it, and then then I read
Aardman
and making a film about it.
Oh, wow. It was so cool. So I got an email because I applied for a job there on the film. I didn't know it was for the film, and then I got an email saying like, this is what the project is, can you come in for an interview? And because they told me, I googled it and I was like, oh my god, I'm running all over Bristol, because I was so excited that like it was an Aardman interview. I was running around Bristol trying to get the books from the library. Libraries in Bristol, just so I could read them before my interview, just in case they asked me a question. I would know what I was talking about. It was so funny. Oh, I was so cute back then. Just walking in for my interview, I was so excited. It was up at the Aztec West Features Department, which is not the big posh Gas Ferry Road one that everyone knows about and you see on the news quite a lot. So it's up in this big warehouse, North Bristol. And there's I walked into the reception and there's this big, like, maquette of a pigeon, like in the Aardman style from Creature Comforts, like up on the wall, covered in bird shit, all like plasticine style with like, fingerprints in and stuff. I was like, oh, awesome! And then in a glass cabinet is the Oscar. It's like, be cool, be cool. And they took me through to the canteen, I think, to get a glass of water before my interview started. My interview was like a whole day; it was a test. Wow. And I was in, like, they just parked me on a sofa and just said, like, sit here, we'll get you a coffee. And I was like, thank you very much. And on the wall is, like, a drawing of Wallace and Gromit signed by Hayao Miyazaki. Drawn by Hayao Miyazaki. And I was like, oh, it's so cool. It's like a toy shop. It's like working in a toy store. And I got a little tour before my test began, so I got to see, like, all the puppets and stuff. And it got better every day from then.
Wow.
So on the Pirates, I was a CG animator, so my test when I went in was like a full day of just CG animation, just to see if you could get the Aardman style quick enough. You got like a little briefing from the animation, the head of animation, Lloyd Price, and a line of dialogue, which was Darwin's dialogue, and you just had to animate for the day, and then that was the test, basically. So I got to spend the day there, and then once then I was working on it. It was... This is really cool because it's going to tie this back to Laika. On the Pirates, it was the first movie they did where they employed the replacement mouse system, the RP animation pipeline, which is obviously what they used at Laika. In fact, the lady who set up the department in Laika Animation came over to Aardman and set it up at Aardman. So we were animating in CG the mouse and the mouth shapes, and then they would be printed out in RP. And use for the animator to then, like, we would animate them, and the animator would know what mouse to put on what frame. Like, it would print out, like, a dope sheet. So then they concentrate on the body performance of the whole thing, and it would speed up production. Now, like, Laika has since gone on to just really push that whole system even further by printing colours, haven't they? Like the... Was it... Oh, Paranorman? That was the first one where they printed, like... gradients and textures and stuff, so that the process would be like it would come out hand like it would look hand done already. It wasn't coloured, like her lip glossy lips and stuff would be printed. Whereas on the Aardman pipeline, because it was quite new, they had a whole team of people having to clean up every single mouse and then hand paint every single mouse before they were even ready to be animated with. And each puppet had like a ginormous amount of mouths that we could animate with, which is really cool. And I absolutely loved building new ones as well, which is a pain in the ass with the people who had to, like, paint and, you know, do that from scratch. One of the really cool things is, like, we would watch the animatic over and over and make sure that we were always ahead of, like, any changes and stuff. And if, like, a shot was coming up that had something a little bit special that wasn't part of their, like, generic mouse set, like, there is a good example of Pirate Captain blowing a kiss. So we didn't have kissy mouths. We had, like, oohs and stuff, like oohs and uhs, but not... So I did a test with the oohs to see if the oohs would work, and then Pete said, like, that's not quite perfect. Like, I really want a puckery mouth. So I had to build, like, puckery mouths. And it was really cool to watch the movie and just know that I had, like, it's my mouth. And I did, like, yeah, a few for the monkey as well, like, Bobo. That had to be, like... So that was really cool. So that was like we were a tiny team. We were a team of three facial animators, and awesome. So we got treated like the animation team. We were always invited to the animation briefings. We were always like we had like an animation meeting every 2 weeks where they would do shot of the week and then watch through the footage that had been shot and talk about like if we were nailing the performances and stuff. And some of the lead animators they were in charge of like the performances of Darwin and Pirate Captain. They were like obviously the most important ones would just say this is really working or like let's try and stay away from this kind of thing. So I got to just witness so much of like how Aardman make a film, and I got to meet so many like hero animators that have worked on everything. It's just a dream come true, literally. Like laughed my ass off all day long for 2 years. It was just the most wonderful place to work. And obviously because like just working on that film, a lot of the animators that worked on Pirates now work at Leica. So at the end of Kubo, I see like people who I know, their names on the big screen was really lovely. So yeah, that was Pirates. I would love to go back as well. Like, it's just such a cool little place. I got to do some background character animation as well, because like they couldn't make every puppet. They had crowds of pirates for the Pirate of the Year awards. Like the crowd would have been a CG crowd, so I got to animate like on 2s and CG, which is really fun. Got to play with like the Aardman rigs. It was quite good. So yeah, that was my part on Pirates. It was awesome, and I got like because of that, like I got invited to the Aardman's 40th anniversary party. That was fun. That was really like, I walked up to the front doors. There was like a big red carpet outside the Coulson Hall in Bristol. They'd taken over the whole building, with like lights and everything, and they've got like these three strong men with like the best mustaches I have ever seen, wearing these tiny little like leopard skin hot pants, these cute little hunting outfits, and they're like lifting each other up and lifting barbells and stuff, and generally just interacting with the crowd and yelling stuff. And I was like, classic.
That sounds so odd. It was good somehow.
Isn't it? That's, everyone was saying the same thing. Like, can't imagine a Aardman party without strong men now. It was really good fun. Yeah, they pulled out. They certainly pull out all the stops and reward the people who work there. Definitely.
That's cool.
Yeah. So
was there Wensleydale there?
What? Yeah, we got Wensleydale. We have got every Christmas. We get presents all the time, and we got Wensleydale in our Christmas presents, which isn't that sweet. Yeah, they were always rewarding us. Like, even on Pirates, I remember one day we all got into work, and it was like, oh, we're all finishing at lunchtime, and we're like, why? And it's like, oh, because the Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain is coming to give us a gig. So we were all in the canteen, like 15 people playing the ukulele, like loads of really awesome ukulele songs, just random things like that. Brian Blessed actually came in for like what one, like his puppet, his character in the film was the Pirate King, and he's like,
of course,
a bit bling. He's like, yeah, he's the king of all pirates, and his character's really blingy, and it took I think he was the last puppet to be finished, or what, like the last major significant build to be done. So when it was finished, they must have invited him in to meet his character. And we all got brought up to the canteen for some reason. Like, no one really knew what was going on. We were just like, everyone in the canteen at 11 o'clock. And we're like, okay. Like, all piling in. And like, there's a crew of about 300. It's probably 300 in total over the whole film. I don't know if there was 300 there on the day. Might be telling porkies. But there's a lot of people in the canteen, and we're all like wondering why, what's going on. And then you just hear like, I don't know if I can do
a boom.
Brian Blessed justice, but like we had this hello, and we're like, what the hell is that? And he comes bounding in through like the door of the canteen, stops there. He's holding this puppet by its leg, like waving it around, and everyone's face is like, what's he doing? And like Peter Lord is like, give me that. I'll hold that. you tell your stories. And so we had like a bit of a Brian Blessed tells his stories kind of, it was hilarious. He must have been there for half an hour. But the funniest thing was there was a girl there for the week doing work experience, and it was her first day. She was like right next to him. Like, it must have been like an absolute accident this happened. And he was like, he just grabbed his arm around her the whole time, and he's like yelling at us all, telling these stories. He's like really animated guy, right? And this girl's just it was so funny. Definitely. And I just can't imagine what she must have told her parents when she got home. Like, how was your first day, sweetie? Oh my god. I got accosted by Brian Blessed in the canteen. It was great. And there's loads of stories like that. I got to meet I got to personally meet Imelda Staunton. I didn't forget. Imelda Staunton was the voice of Queen Victoria in the film, and she came into our department because like Queen Victoria, she's very angry lady. I think, I don't know, in real life, in our film she was, And like, so she had like quite a lot of mouth work. She had a lot of mouth. And and yeah, like Imelda Staunton's like the sweetest little button of a woman. She wanted to meet everyone. She came on for a tour, and like quite often, like the big stars who would come on studio tours wouldn't go everywhere. They'd go on the floor because that's the cool bit where all the puppets are and the animators are the rock stars kind of thing. And we were in just like little CG department. And then, yeah, Imelda Staunton was like, no, I want to meet everyone. So she came around and we got to chat to her and she was so sweet. I think even them. I only saw the back of Hugh Grant. I just saw him like just get back into his car, and I'm like, oh, Hugh Grant, amazing. But actually, we got to see him. He came to the premiere in Bristol. They had the premiere in Bristol, and we all got to go. And Hugh Grant came and personally introduced every screen of the film. Like, we had every screen booked out, and everyone could bring their. I think we had like a plus two. You could bring your friends and family.
Nice.
So I got to bring my family along, see what we'd done, and it was like, it was so cool. They decorated this whole huge cinema, like all sandy beach style, like pirate styles, pirates everywhere. And yeah, like Hugh Grant came and introduced this every single screen, and it must have been staggered. So like he would come in at the front, thank you everyone for all your hard work kind of thing. Peter Lord dressed as a pirate. Yeah, that was good fun. That was a good night. No, I think like I liked the 40th party bit. That was fun. So yeah. Yeah, big childhood dreams, and all. It was just perfect. Wow. I absolutely loved it. I'd go back in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. Just saying. But yeah, like you said, like it's interesting you touched upon like the stop motion and CG sort of. It's a very rocky relationship. They need each other, but they don't like to admit it. So I know I just finished on. Chuck Steele is a very physical film, and I think the director Mike Moore has fought and fought and fought to keep it that way. Like, it would be so much easier if he employed some CG support, but he wants it all handmade and hand sculpted and stuff, and it's all shot on singles. So yeah, like, wow. I've worked on two stop motion films now as a CG-er. I've like both times. I've had very different experiences. So yeah. Ooh. That's it.
Wow.
Any questions?
Well,
that pipeline from like CG specifically for faces, from CG to stop motion is fascinating to me. I mean, just like the nuts and bolts of it, you know. I know. That's really fascinating. I mean, because it's just so interesting, that extra step to sort of push the project into the, you know, real world of stop motion, like hands on puppets what is that? I mean maybe it's a boring question, but like, is there like, is there a spreadsheet, is it a computer, is like, does the internet like get a box of faces, or you know what I mean? Like, you kind of touched on this a little bit, but I'm just really curious about that.
Like, you're gonna love this then.
Okay, great.
Because so when we're animating, we're using a great big facial library. So every mouth shape that we create, we can then save out. And then it's sort of like you're just going shopping for a mouse. It's really funny. Uh-huh. So you just press this shape, I want this one on this key kind of thing. Yeah. And then, yeah, you know, you rock onto your next mouth shape and play it back and make sure it looks all right. Now then once that was approved and it was all animated, it would print out a dope sheet. Every single mouse would have an ID, so mm-hmm. the animator then would know. He'd just have a big long list of numbers.
Wow!
That list then automatically got sent up to the mouse librarian, which is
exactly. This is beautiful. I was hoping. Yeah. This
and then she lived in this like library. It's like just shelves and shelves and shelves and shelves of. It looked really boring on the outside because it's just shelves of brown boxes. She was amazing. She knew where everything was. And obviously, like, it wouldn't go as smoothly for every shot, every single time. And there would be, like, a mouse shortage on, like, this really popular mouse.
Yeah.
So she would ring down and be like, we don't have... She'd ring down and she's like, we don't have 63. Have you got 60? Can you use 64? Is 64 going to work? And I'm like, I'd open my shot, change the mouth. I was like, it's not really working. It's not really an A. I'll try something else. And I reanimate it. And I was like, oh, cool. Have you got mouth 15? And she's like, oh, I'll check mouth 15. Yeah, I've got mouth 15. That's fine. I was like, do that then. And then she would run around, like, these shelves, grabbing little mouths out of little boxes and just create, like, this little, like, a bespoke, just little set that was, like, sectioned off and each mouth was in the box. In fact, I got to... I wish I could send you. I don't have it online anyway, but I did... I'll get to that anyway. So since she would take the little box to the set and that would just be delivered to the animator, here's your mouths, here's your list. And they would then just follow the list with their little box. And it's like a little chocolate box.
That is awesome. It's sectioned
off like little chocolate.
That is awesome.
So on the very, very last... On my last day, I worked really closely with an animator called Andy Spilsted, who's absolutely wonderful, and he's worked on a lot of stuff. And because I did most of his shots with him, he was on The Pirate with Gout quite a lot, I think I remember. we were great friends by the end, obviously, and he came to me and said, do you want to animate my last shot? And I was like, on the floor? Like stop motion? Like, really? And his last shot was a shot for the DVD extras, and it was just... It was explaining the mouth replacement system, and it was a mouth talking in one of these mouth boxes. So it was perfect for me, because I was like, I know exactly what mouth to use. Because by then I knew them all off by heart as well. And it was just this little mouth in the box, just saying a line about, like, the process, what it was. Oh, I'll have to send it to you. I've never put it online because I'm not a stop motion animator, so it's never made it into my CV or my... But, like, I've got it for me, you know? So I'll have to show you. It's really cute. And that's what the boxes look like. The boxes are like little chocolate boxes, and each one had a mouth in it. I've actually... Oh, I probably shouldn't admit this online. But I did... I got given one of... Where is she? I don't know. Cutlass Liz was my favourite character, and I did all her lines, and I've got one of her mouths.
Oh, nice.
I've got a few Arbent trinkets, actually. I've got, like, a tomato plant from... Curse of the Were-Rabbit. Don't know if I should put that on.
Yeah,
cool, huh? And when we finished the film, we all got presented with, you know, the Pirate of the Year award in the film? It's like a big golden skull with a red gem eye, a red ruby eye. We got, every single one of us got a Pirate of the Year award.
Wow.
That is horrible.
That's so cool.
Yeah. It was ace. So yeah, does that answer your question? Like, I love that there's a mouth library, right?
There's
a mouth library.
Perfect. Yeah. That is exactly what I was hoping for. Seriously, I've been so curious about this. Oh, that's great.
Well, that would then, that list that got printed out would then just double up as their dope sheet. So then, like, I did love doing this after the shot was finished, or like if I had to pop on the floor to, like, deliver one. Or just like, oh, here's your dope sheet. Like, I was looking around for, like, to see how each animator does it. You know, like, how do they draw their poses on them, or do they just scribble notes? And, like, often they were, like, just decimated with notes and scribbles and drawings and thumbnails and stuff. And I just loved seeing that. I loved seeing how, like, my system's all on the computer. And then going onto the floor and just seeing it all really hand done was so lovely. It was really cool.
That's incredible. So cool. So cool.
So yeah, I've been offline for like the last few weeks and just not really been checking Twitter very much, which has been bliss, I can tell you. Like, not being in the middle of any petty Twitter stuff is great. But unfortunately, it meant that I missed some sad news, actually, which I only really found out about on Tuesday this week, which was that a Studio Ghibli animator called Makiko Futaki, I think that's how you pronounce her name, died. And she was 57, and, you know, that's not old at all.
No, it's not. That's horrible.
In her career, she actually animated some really quite iconic scenes in Ghibli movies, and like, telling a little bit like of a personal like story here, I was at a bit of a turning point like in my personal life when I was when I first saw Ponyo, I was not sure whether I wanted to just have artwork be something that I did in my spare time and, you know, do a literature course for university or something like that. Anyway, I saw Ponyo, and the scene where Ponyo is running on the waves, literally, like, that was, I can remember the moment, like, when I was sat on, like, a rickety, like, office chair in my room watching this pirate, sorry, copy of Ponyo that my friend had given me, that I saw this animation, and I went, oh, okay, that's fine. I know what I want to do now. I want to do this. I want to, like, if I draw and draw enough, then, like, if I get close to doing that, then that's fine. That's a good pursuit, because the feeling the animation gave me was just like nothing I'd ever felt or seen before. It was, I'd seen animation before, and I had, like, loved, you know, Disney stuff and, like I said, Cartoon Network, Genndy Tartakovsky, stuff like that. But when I saw Ponyo, like, it just, and I'd seen Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away, but for some reason Ponyo was just, it hit me at the right moment.
Mm-hmm.
And this scene blew me away, where Ponyo is running on the waves, and, like, she does, like, a backflip, and then there's this whole scene that follows where she's running on waves, and the whole background is moving, and everything on the screen is animated. It's, like, it's orchestral, like, the way how everything is just sort of, you know, moving and overlapping, and things are moving at different speeds. It blew me away, and I just had to find out who did it. And after about a week of searching, I found, like, this list in Japanese of the animators who worked on Ponyo and their respective scenes that they worked on. And I, like, struggled, and I kind of managed to translate it for myself. And I was like, oh my God, I have a name. I know who did this scene. And from there, I was able to, like, find, like, the rest of her scenes. And I just kind of fell in love with her stuff. It's a bit weird, because, you know, nowadays when there's an artist or an animator or a director or a musician or any kind of artist, you kind of have a sense of, like, their personal life, or, like, they also have a blog and they post about what they do at the weekend. You don't really, like, get that so much with lots of animators.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, with Futaki's stuff, it's kind of, I only really know her through her work, which is really nice, because, like, her work is just speaks for itself, really. It's
was she the one, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but she the one, I remember you were putting images up on Twitter of the different stuff, like, parts that she worked on, like, I know one of those was that iconic Ponyo scene, but I think also that one clip of the forest spirit in Mononoke when it walks on the ground and you see, like, all the grass on the ground just, like, spring to life and then wither away. That was all her.
That was all her. I mean, it seems like almost a bit of a, like, a put down to say she was an artisan. But what I mean by that is, like, she really completely understood, like, that films and all good animators kind of, I think, understand this, and all good background artists and everyone, but she understood her place in telling the story. There was nothing about her work which was, like, trying to show off and, you know, put herself before the film, which is what you can sometimes see in Japanese animation. Actually, you can see a scene which is really trying to stand out, and the animator trying to do something, you know, with a personal, like, streak to it. But her stuff was always really, really on model, and just, it was exquisite. And she was one of, like, Miyazaki's favorites, actually.
Oh, really?
She was always, so animators also tend to be cast to particular scenes. And she was always, like, doing pretty much, if there's a bird in a Ghibli movie and it's beautifully animated, she probably did it, because she was an expert on birds. And as you were saying, Rachel, like, with the scene in Princess Mononoke, like, any plants or flowers, she probably drew. Like, the scene in Totoro where they have the little shoots, and they're doing like the sort of the summoning dance, and the
Where that tree, the giant tree comes out of the ground.
Yeah, that's hers.
Oh, wow.
So she like really, and the thing is, like, if you pause like the films, each frame is just like such a complex, like, almost needlessly complex drawing of a plant. You could tell she really, really loved, but in some ways more importantly, observed nature, and really brought it like to the screen in a really honest way, she obviously simplified her drawing somewhat, but they're not really cartoony. I mean, another one of her scenes which I love is in Laputa, Castle in the Sky, the scene where Pazu comes down in the morning and opens the cage where he's keeping all these doves.
Oh yes.
I mean, that scene, if you look like at the individual drawings, they're these really delicate, and I mean seriously delicate, drawings of these doves, where she's making sure that each feather is properly tapering in a very gentle way, and they move exactly like birds as well. They're not all necessarily like graceful heavenly things. They're a bit like, they're a little bit vicious when Sheeta's like got a handful of seeds and they're all sort of like pecking her hand, and so she really understood like the complexity of nature in the way that I think people kind of understand Ghibli movies to be able to do, where there's like a fury to them and a beauty to them. Like another thing she animated was the forest god in Princess Mononoke, the giant blue thing that that, you know, like a titan that sort of moves moves through. And she also animated the scene in Totoro where Mei meets Totoro.
Oh yep.
So she has that under her belt. She has at the start of Kiki's Delivery Service, where she's just sitting there and the grass is blowing.
This movie was amazing.
Yeah, I know, like, these are like some of the more iconic like scenes out of the like each of these Ghibli films.
Yeah. Yeah, and
that's so cool.
Yeah, and so. As I was sort of like getting into animation, I was kind of getting to learn different animators and everything. And when you get to like recognize animators' scenes, it's really exciting because there are certain things going on in their scenes which you can sort of identify them for because they'll be cast, like I said, to particular types of scenes.
Kind of like what was the one animator from Disney that I've started noticing a lot more of his work? It was when he was working for Disney. It was Glenn Keane.
Oh right, yeah.
Kind of like that. Like you'd be able to like look at his animation, like stuff that he worked on, and be able to tell like, okay, he worked on this scene or that character by, you know, like certain tells in their animation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's a really exciting thing when you sort of you get to know someone's work like in that kind of quite intimate way.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing which you might be surprised that she animated was not just to give you a complete list, but I find it interesting.
No, I find it interesting too. Go ahead.
She also animated the giant when Tetsuo turns into like a giant flesh baby, basically.
Oh, I was going to say about Akira, because
yeah,
what happened was she passed away sort of about, I think it's the 13th of May. And it was reported on like anime websites, or Anime News Network and stuff, but then for some reason it got picked up like last weekend by it started popping up everywhere, like on film websites and general geek. So it's, I think one place must have picked up on it, like, and then it spread. And some of the places were saying Ghibli and Akira animator.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I didn't know that bit.
No. I didn't know that actually about her until like a few years ago. But when you see those scenes, you go, oh yeah, she's sort of like moving things at different times, like the way she does, I don't know, like when the flowers are withering underneath the forest god's feet in Princess Mononoke. So her work really had a huge like effect on me, because, you know, going through her stuff frame by frame, I really got to like appreciate you know, the delicacy she has for like drawing flowers mainly. I think that was really her strongest suit, was realistically like in as realistic a way that animation can manage to depict like the wind just blowing gently over plants and things. And anyway, so she was easily one of my all-time favorite animators. So I'm so pleased that like she got to do all those iconic scenes. And I thought it was worth, you know, mentioning what those scenes were, because I noticed lots of news outlets that kind of picked it up, sort of said, oh yeah, she worked on this film. Mm. But you don't really know what that means, I don't think, unless you know, you'd just be doing guesswork about like what she did.
Especially if you know, yeah, exactly. If you can't like how you explained how you can link her work to certain bits of animation, like all the different moments that you said that she animated, those are really impressive. If you really look at it, it's just, it's incredible. It's literally just, oh man.
Yeah. I was so pleased as well when I found out that she animated the last moments in The Wind Rises.
Oh, right.
That was her too? Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So like the scenes where basically, the main character's like, you know, in the weird sort of grasslandy heaven place.
And had talking to his one mentor character.
Those last like 30 seconds, I think, of her.
Oh, I love that entire scene. So she got
all the stuff in House Moving Castle where he's a bird as well. So anyway,
oh my god.
So I was actually really really sad when I found out she died, but looking back through her career, is I can't help but just be uplifted by it, because that's what her scenes kind of gave me. They were just always the best parts in those movies for me. One scene that is probably like her most realistic scene in terms of just the sheer amount of detail was in a Takahata film. And she didn't often actually work with Takahata. She was more sort of like Miyazaki's fave, I think. But
yeah, you mentioned that earlier, and given her ability to draw aspects of nature really well, I can kind of see why.
But in only yesterday, she animated the scenes with the safflowers.
Oh my gosh. I'm sorry, I keep saying that just all the time, but just throughout this conversation, but it's so cool.
And in the making of Only Yesterday, which I'll send a link on the show notes to, there's a great little bit of footage of her actually picking the safflower herself.
Wow.
Barehanded to really feel the texture. And then spending like a year just drawing them. And I think it paid off.
No, yeah, at least definitely, especially in that scene in the movie where they, you know, they have that long, nice sequence where they're showing you, you know, how they're going about picking them. And it's just, you look at those flowers and it's like, I remember when the first time watching that movie, I'm just like, ah, those are just like beautifully animated. Like they're so detailed and everything. And it's like, now I know why. Now I know who to thank for that. That's incredible.
Yeah, I'm kind of pleased that I'm under quite unfortunate circumstances, you know, I'm able to sing her praises, really, because animators being quite like humble private people, you wouldn't usually hear this stuff. So there it is. Check out her stuff, and I'm gonna write another little article, I think, for the site.
Cool.
And actually include some of the scenes if I can, as GIFs or as video links.
That'd be fantastic.
Because I really want everyone to know about her.
No, well, it totally should.
Yeah, thanks so much for that. That was really, really enlightening, and I think paid fitting tribute to an awesome person.
Agreed.
And also, today we have a special guest, the one, the only, Ed Hooks.
Hello. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you. You've been following our podcast for quite a while, and we've been very appreciative for your advice and on how to make the podcast better, and just great having talks with you about animation for adults. So I wanted to try and see if we could have us all talk about that today, with what defines animation for adults. But before we get into that, we just want to give the microphone over to Ed and just kind of basically introduce himself to anyone who may not know him. So go ahead, Ed, the floor is yours.
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, first of all, I just want to thank you for having me here. I'm a fan of the show, and not only am I a fan, I think what you're doing is important, and I'm honored to be here. And I also, before time goes by, I just want to give a shout out to Yvonne here with her Animation Nights in New York, because she's also doing something very, very important, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's doing a great job with it. And I just think all of you guys really deserve a applause. If there was an audience here, I'd lead it.
Thank you.
So my background is that I was an actor for 30 years, and also I taught acting classes during that time, to professional level acting classes. And in 1996, I was invited to teach animators for the first time at DreamWorks PDI. They were working on the movie Ants at that time, that had Woody Allen doing the lead voice there. And I had to figure out how to teach animators. I went in there and I really sort of screwed it up at first, because I tried to teach the animators the way that I was teaching actors. And then I discovered that you just didn't do that. And we had to get the animators all together, and I told them, I understand, I think, something about acting, but I don't think I understand much about animation at all, and you need to show me how you do what you do, and if I can understand that, then maybe I can bring to bear what I know in a way that'll be useful to you. And so they gave me a chair to push around, and I sat next to the animators, and we talked, and I watched until I had my big aha moment and realized what the difference was between animators and actors. The main difference is that actors work in the present moment, and animators don't have a present moment. Animators have 24 frames make a second, or an illusion of a present moment. So once I realized that, then I said to myself, okay, how do you teach acting theory to adults and people who really need to understand acting, but who don't want to be acting on Broadway and don't want to be in movies with Robert De Niro? What do you do? And so I had the opportunity to experiment, frankly, and that's what I did. And I worked out a way of teaching them that involved showing them clips and deconstructing the clips from films, showing them how acting works, lecture discussion, very little actual on-your-feet stuff, because it was the on-your-feet stuff that they were skittish about. So after all that was over, I wrote a book about it. I wrote Acting for Animators, which was first published in 2001. And the book was embraced by the industry, and I suppose that everything what you're getting today is the tail end of that. And I've now taught at most of the major animation studios and video game companies and around the world, international. I teach around the world. So that's me, and I have a new book that'll be out in December called Craft Notes for Animators, A Perspective on 21st Century Career. I'm very, very lucky to do what I do. I work with some of the most creative and talented people in the world. And I count my blessings all the time. I don't take it for granted. It's a great privilege to do what I do. So that's who I am. I live in Los Angeles right now, and my wife and I are just about to move to Lisbon, Portugal.
Ah, that's a big move.
It's a big move. It's uprooting and transplanting one of those big trees in Big Sur. You know, moving international is a big thing. But we're having fun with it. The move should be complete within the next month or so.
All right.
That's excellent. Yeah, I mean, I was able to see your talk at CGCon in Montreal, of all places. Oh. It sort of gave me the CGCon was moved. It was going to be in New York City, and I was just like, oh, well, I haven't been to Montreal ever, so it was sort of an excuse for me to go there. But it was such an inspiring experience, and I just kept on talking about it. Like the moment after it happened, I told everyone I could find who didn't know already about, you know, what you're doing. You know, I would lead them to your website because it was so inspiring. I mean, it's just one of those experiences that make you want to get immediately back to work with enthusiasm.
Thank you very much. I care a lot about animation and the animators who I work with. And it's a great privilege. It really is. I mean, I'm just a very, very lucky guy.
Yeah, but you're bringing so much value. I mean, you're doing frame-by-frame analysis of full feature-length films now, right?
Yes, because I have found that that's a very good way for people to have a real-world application. I mean, we can sit and talk about theory, acting theory. I'm happy to do that. I can do that most of the day about acting theory and principles. But at some point, somebody has to actually put animation up and say, okay, does this work? If not, why not? Mm-hmm. And when you're animating, most of what you do, it's going to be pretty evident what the character is doing. It's clear. But sometimes you get things where it's not so clear. And you should be able to figure it out. You should be able to find out why, you know, why. You should know why something works and why it doesn't. And so I try with these going through the films and showing clips and getting the people in the class to explain to me why the scenes work or why scenes don't work. I just found it to be a very useful teaching tool. And so I do include film analysis in my books. And as time has gone by, they've become more and more detailed. I do them now complete with time code. And so if somebody has the book, what they do is get a hold of the DVD or find it online, and then they can follow along with my notes and watch, and then they can really get a sense of the how the acting and the performance is working in there.
That's really interesting.
That's exactly what I did, actually. Your book, Ed, was really, really helpful to me personally as a student.
Mm-hmm.
I think actually you came to my school in Bournemouth. I think in 2000.
It's a great school.
Yeah, thanks. And I mean, and your lecture that you gave and your visit sort of gave me this new understanding of what acting for animation was, because I mean, it's kind of learning animation is one thing and learning acting for animation is another whole way of thinking, really. It's not really about movement. It's not about how fast some moving, which seems to be what animators kind of get preoccupied with sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And your approach to, you know, objective and obstacles, really driving like behavior was something which, I found completely invaluable.
Well, it moves, it keeps everyone away from cliche, right? So, and they can delve into their own well of knowledge just from being a human being.
Mm.
It instills confidence too, I think. I mean, what you're doing is very important.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's, it's what it is technique. That's what you call technique. When you're animating a sequence and something isn't working, you should be able to figure it out pretty quickly. You shouldn't just have to pull it out of the air and say, well, maybe this works better if I do this, maybe not. There's concrete ways to figure out why something is working. If it's character animation, you ask your character. Well, number one, a very important thing I can say right here is that everybody has heard this expression that the animator is an actor with a pencil. It's a very popular expression, and it's true in a sense, but it's not literally true. The actor in an animation is the character on the screen. Mm-hmm. From the audience's perspective, the actor is Mickey Mouse. It's not Walt Disney. And so the animator's relationship with the character is one of empathetic direction.
Oh.
What you have to do as an animator is to teach your character and help your character be a good actor. And so you have to have, as an animator, you have to have a solid understanding of acting in order to be able to teach it and help and direct your character. But it's the character that's the actor. And I just think that, so you should be able to, at any time, freeze frame a character and say to that character, what are you doing? And the character should be able to answer in theatrical terms. And the theatrical terms are, this is the objective that I'm pursuing. This is the action that I'm playing to achieve that objective. And this is the obstacle that I'm overcoming. Mm-hmm. It's that simple. Yeah. If you ask your character, what are you doing? And the character says, well, I just feel sad. You say, okay, and what are you doing? Yeah, but I just feel bad. I just am sad right now. Yes, so what are you doing? The character needs to be doing something. And that doesn't mean necessarily a whole lot of physical action. You can have not much physical action. But the character needs to have something that they're doing. And so really what acting for animators is that I teach is really technique. It's what to do when you don't know what to do, when the script is unclear. You need to know how to make it work. You need to know how to give a character an objective if there's not one there, if it's not really evident what the character's doing. I want people to understand the principles and then make it work for themselves in their own way.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
That is true, actually, because Ed, your book, I think it was Acting in Animation.
Mm-hmm. Acting for Animators is the name of my books. But...
Oh, sorry, sorry. It was a particular book that you did that was, I think it was, you were analyzing performances from different animated movies.
You know what? You've got a better memory than I do. I did. That is one of my books. It was, it's, the book is Acting in Animation, A Look at 12 Films.
Exactly.
Yes.
And the fact that it's a variety of films. You've got like Iron Giant, Tarzan, I think a Wallace and Gromit film, Spirited Away. And when you look at them, they look like, you know, if you looked at a screenshot from each movie, you'd think it was a different style. Mm-hmm. And the style of movement in those movies is kind of slightly different. And how far like the notches on exaggeration are turned, vary. But mm-hmm. I think what you're saying is those sort of those principles are consistent throughout, yes. Regardless of the style.
They could be. I tell you something about generations, though, generations of animators, and some of this actually it comes out in that book that the craft notes for animators. You know, Walt Disney's big contribution to animation was that he gave Mickey Mouse a brain. that was what he did. Once Mickey Mouse had a brain, a human brain, then the mouse could think, could form opinions, could develop values, and those values could be expressed as emotion. That was a huge breakthrough back then, 1936, 37. It was enough of a breakthrough to where that alone would sell movie tickets. Because people wanted to see it on screen, this sort of magic with the characters that seemed to come to life. But, and this is really important for I think all of your listeners, is that Walt Disney had to figure out acting from scratch. When he did what he did, Konstantin Stanislavski's work had not been published yet in English. There were no textbooks. There was nothing. There was a couple of little thin little books that had been put out by some people who had studied with Stanislavski, but there was almost no literature. And Disney and his wonderful animators, they had to figure it out so what they figured out was that how empathy works. They called it, they wanted the audience to care for the character, and they figured out that in order for the audience to care, that the characters had to be emotional. They had to show emotion. What Walt Disney did not understand yet was that emotion itself is not actable. Emotion is an automatic value response. Emotion tends to lead to action. Acting is doing. It's not acting is feeling. Although acting takes place in an arena of emotion, you cannot act emotion. And even today, animators struggle with this because many of them are taught to make sure their character has personality. And, you know,
interesting.
When analyzing films, sometimes I look at the DVD and I listen to the director's narration that goes along with these things. And many times there'll be a scene on the screen where the character is expressing emotion of some kind. They're very happy, they're very sad, whatever. And the director is saying, look at that performance. That is such a wonderful performance. And I'm looking at this and I'm saying, the character is not doing anything. The character is simply expressing emotion. You can do that, but you can't just hang your hat there. That's not where it stops. The character has to do something. And understanding that is a really critical thing. Let me tell you a little story, and I'll ask you a question, okay? I'm going to put this to you as a question.
Go for it.
Okay. I was working at an animation event, and I had, as happens at these events, this happened to be one in England, up at Animex is where it was. And what they do is they have dinners for the speakers. They put you together with other people, presenters. And my dinner mate that night was a guy who introduced himself as being the head of animation for Big Hero 6 at Disney. And he didn't know that I had recently written an article that was fairly critical of Big Hero 6. It hadn't been published yet, but I decided not to to ruin his dinner. And this is a true story. And so I said to him, you know what my favorite sequence in that movie is? And he said, no, what is that? And I said, it's where what is the inflated character? I'm forgetting his name.
Baymax,
yeah. It's where Baymax gets drunk and actually he starts deflating and the power runs out of him and Hero has to take him back to plug him in, has to take him to the house. Do you guys remember that sequence?
Yes, very well.
Yeah, and it was a brilliant sequence. I thought from beginning to end, when he starts losing his power until that thing is over, I don't know how long it lasts, maybe 5 minutes. It's a long sequence, and I thought it was really excellent, just top of the line. And so he thanked me for my compliment. And then he said, well, you know, it wasn't always like that. And I said, oh, no. And he said, no. He said, originally we had Baymax in a shopping cart. And he said, but somebody at some point there, one of the story people, took him out of the shopping cart and it just worked so much better. And I said, right. It would. You know why? And he said, well, it was funnier. And I said, right. It would be. You know why? And he said, we just all agreed. It just was funnier this way. Now, I know why, but he didn't understand, that particular guy did not understand the principle of acting. Just based on what I've told you so far in this conversation, you should know what's wrong with Baymax being in the shopping cart. Can one of you tell me?
I'll take a whack at it. My guess would be basically because of the fact that he is being in the shopping cart, that takes away his trying to move in spite of his, you know, the fact that he's low power and, you know, not functioning as well. But you still don't get to see the effort he's trying to put into in trying to move to get to where he needs to go to.
Exactly.
And Hero's struggling with him to get him there.
You got it. If you put Baymax in the shopping cart, if you freeze frame Baymax, because remember I said you should be able to freeze frame a character and say, what are you doing? If you were to freeze frame Baymax in a shopping cart and say, what are you doing? he would say he wouldn't have an answer, because all he was doing was waiting for Hero to get him back to the house, to push him in the shopping cart, to get him back to the house to plug him in. Well, that right there, as soon as you ask a character, what are you doing, and the character doesn't have an answer, then you know what needs to be fixed. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know how much they spent over there at Disney animating this thing with Baymax in the shopping cart, but it was wasted money, totally wasted money. And if they had understood, freeze frame, what are you doing? This is my objective. This is my action. This is the obstacle. Nobody would have ever put him in a shopping cart in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so this is what I mean by acting theory being technique, so that you're able to say, you know, what's right, what's wrong, how does this work, what is the purpose? Every character should be able to answer the question, what are you doing? Emotion is not actable. Thinking tends to lead to conclusions. Emotion tends to lead to action. Also, let me just say this about action. All action involves physical action to some degree. But it doesn't have to involve a whole lot. If you look at Japanese animation, for example, you often will see seconds go by of stillness on screen, and yet you still are very interested. You're held with what's going on. Miyazaki, you know, is masterful with this. I'm got two thoughts going on at one time. You have to forgive me.
That's okay.
Miyazaki was asked one time, what is the difference between his animation and Western animation? And he said, in order to answer the question, he began to clap his hands. And he said, when I clap my hands, what you hear is the sound of the clap. And he said, you don't hear what's in between the sound of the clap. He said, but in Japan, we have a name for what's in between the sound of the clap. We call it ma, like mama.
Right.
Ma. And he said, Western animators tend to be afraid of ma. They think that unless you make the sound of the clap, you're going to lose your audience. And he said, I disagree with that. He said, I think if you fill ma with thinking, emotion, intention, that you will not lose your audience. Mm-hmm. I agree 100% with Miyazaki on this. And if I can, here's the thing. Like, okay, Rachel.
Yep.
If I were to ask you to lie down on the floor and pretend to be a digital character yourself. I want you to be as still as it's possible for you to be, so that you appear not even to be living. Okay, I know you could do that. Now, as soon as you get into that position and you're as still as possible, I say to you, okay, now, holding that, I want you to multiply 323 times 64. Your eyes would move. You're not going to be able to compute it without your eyes moving. Mm-hmm. That little bit of movement is all you would need. That would be theatrically valid, because your objective would be to find the answer to the question, the answer to the arithmetic problem. The action is to do the arithmetic. You have conflict with your situation because you're holding still and trying to be a digital person. That is theatrically valid with almost no physical movement, very little physical movement. An audience will be fixated on that. They'll watch you for a long time doing that. And the Miyazaki and the Japanese animators understand this much better than the American animators, I think. But it's a really good point. So animation does involve movement, but it doesn't have to involve gesturing and gesticulating on every single syllable of every single word. It doesn't have to be that way.
Mm-hmm. That's really true. I think the issue sometimes stems from, oh, I'm an animator, I make things move, and they kind of think, well, I gotta earn my paycheck. I've gotta make things move, because if I'm seen, I think in the moment, you know, when you're working on something, it is easy to lapse and to think, this needs to be moving, and it's obviously wrong, but in a sense to think, if I'm not moving this, I'm being a bit lazy. Even if it is, in fact, not lazy because you're thinking, you know, very hard about the overall effect of the performance and the behavior. I think that's kind of how that stuff comes about, the overacting. And it's really easy to do.
Yes, it is. I tell you something else, too. You guys will appreciate this. I mean, I look at a lot of what they call these 11-second animations.
Oh, yeah.
You know, people send me these things because they're a favorite teaching tool. And what they do is they pull dialogue, usually off of some YouTube clip from a live-action movie or something. And especially in the West, dialogue is usually recorded before the animation is done. So the animator sits there with these headphones on and then makes the on-screen character fit the voice. Mm-hmm. This leads to the conclusion that the voice, the words, must be the most important thing, because the animation has to fit those words. In fact, acting has almost nothing to do with words. Our sense of sight is far more powerful than our sense of hearing. And what you show an audience overrides what they hear. And I wish that more animators understood this, how powerful they are. An animator is actually in the driver's seat. Even though the marketing for these movies that you see, they talk about this star, that star. It's all marketing stuff.
Yeah, totally. You know what's so funny is at the 11 Second Club has sort of a partnership with Animation Mentor, which I attended Animation, a bunch of their programs. I loved Animation Mentor. But we did as an exercise as part of our acting and animation class. And basically, it was just that, like taking a piece of VO from a film, and then doing a bunch of takes in front of a camera, like in our own kitchens or whatever. But the cool thing about it, and the thing that really I think points to what you're saying, is, you know, because, like, for instance, from personal experience, you know, I wound up doing like, you know, 100 takes or whatever, because I'm not an actor. But what it did is it wore me down to the point that by the time I was acting, actually thinking about the dialogue, I was so just divorced from the actual voice that I was I broken myself down, and I was just acting like I normally would. Do you know what I mean? I was creating this other sense of a character. It was my own interpretation, and that's what I wound up using.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Animation Mentor is good stuff. I mean, I have a number of friends that are mentors for Animation Mentor, and it's a really good organization. And the whole idea of mentoring people is great. That's fine. It's wonderful. But unless somebody tells a new animator that the visuals are actually more important than the words, they have to figure this out for themselves. And that's, I just see a lot of times I see animators struggling, trying to make their animation fit the words. And it's, animators are just more powerful than sometimes they think they are.
And a very, very special guest today to talk with us about the development of The Little Prince is the film's director, Mark Osborne.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Yay, we're doing very well. Thank you.
I'm happy to be here. Big fan, big fan.
Thank you so much. We do our best, but we were really happy to have the opportunity to get to see The Little Prince, and I don't know if you had an opportunity to check out our episode where we discussed it, but it was probably one of the best times we have ever had talking about that movie.
Yeah, no, it was a blast. I mean, I've been a fan. I think as an adult who loves animation, I completely support what you guys are doing. And I was very happy to hear that you like the film.
Get the ball rolling. I guess in order to, introduce anyone in our, any one of our followers who might not know exactly other than the what you've worked on, other than The Little Prince, would you mind giving us a little rundown about other things you've been doing in your career?
Yeah, sure. Well, I began just by making short films. I got really interested in animation and making films primarily in stop motion at first. And I did a couple short films that got me some attention and got me noticed, here and there, and kind of one thing led to another. But my short film More that I made in 1998 ended up getting nominated for an Academy Award and won Best Short Film at Sundance and got my foot in the door in a bunch of places, one of them being DreamWorks feature animation. And I went there to get some experience in features and kind of was shocked and surprised at the end of a very long process of making Kung Fu Panda I was one of two directors on that project that helped to bring that to fruition. And it was an incredible experience. But that ended up opening doors for me to be able to create a film like The Little Prince. Little Prince actually kind of fell in my lap and became an incredible opportunity to explore not only, telling this beautiful, wonderful story, in a cinematic way, but as a way that sort of combined all the work that I had done leading up to it. It was like a personal film. It was like one of my short films, but it was also combining sort of my experience working in big budget animated features like Kung Fu Panda.
Mm-hmm. So it was like a combination of both of those elements, like an independent film, but also having a bit more of a backing behind it.
It was completely independent, and that was one of the incredible opportunities, is that it was going to be done outside the studio system, because I really believe that, the book didn't lend itself to something that was going to be done completely within the system. Mm-hmm. But because the book is so well known, the two French producers who had approached me about joining the project as the director, they had this plan where they were going to raise money from all the territories all over the world where the book is really well known. It's been translated into 260 different languages, and the book's been around for more than 70 years at this point, so it has a very broad reach. So they kind of had this ambitious idea that they wanted to be able to make a film that would play all over the world. The book is global, so they wanted to make a film that was global. And so it kind of created this really interesting opportunity to make a very independent, very, very creative project, but one that also would have, I think, the resources to be somewhere in between, your typical small indie film and your big budget studio film. So it kind of, created a situation that I don't think I ever could have imagined. And not a lot of people really understand that. There's a lot of sort of confusion about the project, because we never had a studio partner with the project. It was done completely independently. And like I said, all the financing came from various sources. So we never actually had one studio that was controlling us, because we had different distribution partners in every single territory all over the world. Mm-hmm. So it kind of created this unprecedented opportunity to creatively control the project.
Yeah, I believe I remember you saying in your presentation in Annie that was basically a lot of that was due to the fact that just because this story is such a, it's such a worldwide, critically acclaimed story, and that it just, like, the name alone was enough to carry it through
Yeah, you would think it was all you needed. It was even with the name recognition and, you know, the brand recognition. You know, I thought it was going to be much easier to get this film off the ground, but it took quite a while to actually lock up all the financing necessary for us to pull it off. Mm-hmm. So even with a recognized name and brand like this, it was still incredibly challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could you elaborate a little bit maybe on some of those challenges that came up?
Well, when I joined the project, you know, it appeared that all the funding was in place, but there was still so much work to do to get all the different partners committed to the project. And so one of the things that we did early on, instead of just writing a script so that everybody could understand the story we were going to tell, we had to create a lot of artwork. We created a lot of visual props. I created this, I conceived of this thing called the Magic Suitcase, that was really just like a one-of-a-kind sort of artistic prop that was created to show off the ambition and the creativity for the project. And that Magic Suitcase was something that I brought in to financiers and distributors and actors and artists all across the project, like all over the world. I would bring this Magic Suitcase in to pitch the story and explain how we were going to take care of this book, and not just exploit it, but we were going to actually create a film that would be a loving tribute, that would be meant to protect the book and allow the book to be sort of the beating heart of a larger story that was going to be celebrating the power of the book. So these are very sort of big ideas that we needed to convince people of. And so it really took quite a bit of effort, I think, to make sure that people understood exactly what we were planning to do, but also to understand the ambition of and the high level of commitment that we all had to take care of this book first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember you mentioned that before. And also you said that you had a deeper history with the book. So when you were approached for this project, you were a little hesitant. I think you said that first coming on, saying that this was just one of those projects that you just weren't sure if you wanted to try and even touch.
Yeah, it's a book that, if you know the book, you know the book is meaningful to you. And there are a lot of people who don't know the book, but if you do know the book, it probably has a place in your life and in your heart. And for me, you know, I knew the book so well that when I was first approached and asked if I wanted to make a big animated movie out of the book, I just said no. I said it's impossible, you know, because the book really does, I think it lives in the imagination of the reader in a very special way. Each person kind of perceives the book in a different way. And so when I first imagined it as a big movie, I just was like, no, the book will break. If you try to stretch the book out, it will break. And but then I sort of went into my own experience with the book, and I kind of started thinking about how the book had really impacted me. And what I started to realize is there was maybe a larger opportunity to celebrate the power of the book and how it can change somebody's life. Because the book actually was given to me not as a child, but back when I was about 20 years old. My wife, who we were just dating in college at the time, she actually gave me her copy of the book when we were going to have like a long distance relationship. I got accepted into CalArts to study animation. We met in New York at Pratt Institute. And when I got into animation, I was going to have to move all the way across the country, and I didn't want to be separated from her. And I kind of was coming up with every excuse why I shouldn't go. And she was incredibly supportive, and she would actually, was saying things like, you know, we'll always be together even if we're apart. And she would actually quote the book in letters to me, and she would say, it is only with the heart that one could see rightly what is essential is invisible to the eye. And she eventually gave me her copy of the book as a way to keep us bonded and keep us connected. And, you know, the fact that we're now married and we have two children and we've kind of gone through this experience of making the movie, like, it's just crazy to me when I look all the way back at that very pivotal moment in my life and in my development as an artist and a filmmaker. And the fact that she was actually using that book as a way to sort of push me along and to encourage me, but also as a way to help kind of keep us connected, you know, was really kind of, it's kind of extraordinary when I look back at it. But it was, you know, the more I thought about it, the more I realized, wait a minute, I can't say no to this opportunity because of the fact that I have this significant connection and I have this, you know, the fact that my life was really altered by this book. I started to sort of look for a way that we could actually, you know, tell a story about how the book can alter your life. And so that's, that, you know, that's just the earliest stages of the process, because I really wanted to explore this idea further. And, you know, and that was really the beginning of it for me. And then I started, you know, connecting with other artists and other people that also love the book and that wanted to kind of help also go down this road. And over the years of making the movie, it's been, you know, the book has been like a magnet that has really drawn incredible artists to the fold that were going to bring their own experiences with the book. And, you know, we as a collective group were really looking to find a way to tap into the universal ideas in the book, and the universal themes and all of the things that across cultures and borders have connected us all together in this experience of knowing the power of this book. And so that was sort of like the reason I said no at first was also the reason I ended up saying yes. And I tell my wife throughout the whole process, I would tell her when things are really particularly bad, I would turn to her and say, you know, well, this is all your fault, you know.
I blame you for this.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's you can definitely tell when looking at the movie. I know we definitely could tell when we all saw it that it's the passion that you and your team had for this story in particular, and the way you were able to honor the story but also tell a story around it, like you said, was like the passion was coming through in every single, like, you know, movement of the characters and, you know, line. And it was such a joy to watch. And I guess I wanted to lean that into a question I had in terms of like the development, because I know you had one of the stylistic choices of the film is that you had two different forms of animation going on at two different points in the movie, when the retelling the sections of the book in more of like a stop motion style while the rest of the film was in computer generated. Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Sure. It was one of the big ideas, I think, that also helped it move forward as a project. You know, in the beginning, the idea was just to adapt the book. And one of the big ideas I presented back to the French producers, in addition to sort of saying we're going to tell a larger story around the book, was this notion that we would use different techniques, and primarily we would use stop motion to protect the book by, you know, allowing for the book to stay small at the heart of the movie, but allowing the stop motion to be a very handmade, very artistic, very sensitive and emotional kind of way for us to portray the very poetic nature of the book. But we would use computer animation as a way to contrast with the stop motion. And so this was a big, crazy idea. And it didn't actually become a reality until we were pretty deep into the production, because everybody would say, oh, this is a great idea, but how are we going to do that? Like, how is that going to work? And nobody quite understood, you know. And I didn't even understand at the beginning. I was just like, it felt right to me. It felt like the right way to approach it. But it wasn't until Jamie Collieri ended up joining the project. And if you don't know Jamie's work, he's an extraordinary filmmaker and a friend of mine ever since CalArts. And I've always admired his work. He's probably most well-known for a animated spot that he did for United Airlines called Dragon. And it's a beautiful, beautiful, it's all rendered in paper, and it's incredible. And I've always been a fan of that, and I've always been inspired by his work. He uses paper quite a bit. And in fact, when I was struggling trying to figure out how we were going to do this, he ended up making a music video for The Shins, for the Rifles. And he worked with his longtime collaborator on that, his production designer and character designer named Alex Juhas. And the two of them together made this music video for The Shins. And it was the first time that Jamie was actually using puppets to tell a story. And he was going beyond sort of flat paper. And I saw that and it almost knocked me over. And I just, you know, I called him up and I was like, please, you have to be a part of this. And so Jamie came onto the project really not, he didn't know the book very well, but he understood the importance of it. And he understood the sheer necessity that we get it right. And he understood this notion that the book was going to be the heart of the movie. And so it was really amazing to have him join the project, not only for his artistic contribution, but just because it really helped tremendously. Jamie is really a genius, and he's also the inventor, along with his brother, of this software called DragonFrame, which is state-of-the-art stop-motion software. Mm-hmm. And so he's a great filmmaker and storyteller, but he's also got this amazing sort of genius technical mind as well. And anyway, Jamie coming on board and bringing along Alex Juhas really helped, I think, bring this very sort of abstract idea into reality. And so the stop motion sequences are pretty much, you know, the make or break thing for the whole movie. And so it was really kind of a thrill to be able to work with Jamie and collaborate with Jamie on those sequences. And he created, you know, a lot of momentum for the project. And when we started to get footage back from stop motion, it was before we had finished footage for CG. And so the stop motion footage ended up kind of guiding and driving the quality of light that we used throughout the whole movie. And, you know, it was incredibly helpful, and it really buoyed the whole production for us to have this material that was so inspiring and, I think really guided us quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were all really impressive sequences. Like I remember the paper, the and bits of animation where it looked like it was all just paper, and then once the little prince shows up, it seems like it takes a jump swing. Like it's still the stop motion, it's still made of paper, but it like took on a whole nother dimension.
Right. It actually goes from you know, we say there's two forms of animation in the movie. There's actually four and a half kinds of animation, because we start with hand drawn. You know, the movie begins with, just as you would expect, it's just like the drawings from the book move a little bit, and then we go into computer animation. Then the first time we go into stop motion, it's a very flat, it's like a multi-plane flat paper look, so that's more technically cut out animation. And then it goes more dimensional into full stop motion, but again, yeah, using paper as much as possible. Everything that you see in the stop motion sequences is surfaced with paper, or it's made out of paper in some way. And this was a really important way for us to link not only to the book and to the pages that the book is written on, but more specifically, it was meant to link to those pages that the little girl is reading the story on, these old yellow, you know, crumpled up pieces of paper that the aviator has been carrying around his whole life. You know, that was the thing that we were using as a major link between these two different, very different worlds. The texture and the quality of the paper and the way light would come through the paper was the real, really, really vital link between these two very different techniques.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dan, Chris, you guys have anything you want to add? I don't want to feel like I'm taking over the whole.
No, not at all. No, it's just fascinating to listen to. Yeah, I mean, like, obviously, just the passion, like the personal like passion that you have for the story, Mark, really comes through in the movie. But it's really fascinating to hear, just the role that the book sort of like played in your personal life, and as you're saying, like, you know, the understandable sort of, oh, this is too big a deal for me to tackle. But it's fascinating to hear that was the sort of push-pull that kind of drove you to make the movie.
It's even more complicated because of the fact that there are many, many different adaptations that already exist. And so that was another thing that I was aware of. I had seen there was a live-action musical made in 1974, directed by Stanley Donen, and that was like, okay, that was the book kind of stretched out with like musical numbers added in to kind of pad it out. And so I kind of was aware of that. So I was like, okay, you can't do that. You know, it's like I kind of had all these examples of things that you couldn't do. And, so that was also another reason why we had to find a very novel approach. We had to find a very interesting way in and something that would both work whether you knew the book or not. That was the other thing, is like, there are a lot of people who know the book, but there's a lot of people who don't know the book. And so it had to work as a movie and stand alone on its own. But it also had to be this faithful adaptation. And I think that was one of the breakthroughs, was realizing that, you know, we needed to adapt the work. We needed to adapt the words on the page, but it was more important for us to adapt the emotional experience, what was between the lines, the personal experience that someone can have when they read the book. And that was, I think, what became sort of the main mission that we were all sort of committed to, was like finding the right way to explore that emotional experience. And I remember that was part of the pitch, was saying like, we were adapting the emotional experience that people can have with the book as much as we were adapting the book itself. And that, I think, was our responsibility. Now that the book has been around for 70 years, that was our responsibility to figure out how to do that, because it was more than just a book at this point. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, actually, the craziest thing that inspired that was when I was trying to figure out what to do with this book, I hit a brick wall, and this was very, very early on, and I almost gave up on it, because I was like, this is crazy, you know, this can't be done. And I discovered just randomly that Orson Welles was adapting the book back in 1943, before the book was even published. He was actually adapting the book to be his follow-up to Citizen Kane.
Oh, wow.
And he wanted to use, he wanted to use animation and live action. He wanted to, he wrote four drafts of a screenplay, and it never came to fruition. And I kind of stumbled on this news, and that's when I was like, I'm just going to get one of his scripts, and I'm going to use one of his scripts, and that's how I'm going to do it. And I ended up kind of waiting. It was very hard to get them. The Saint-Exupéry estate had the scripts, and so they managed to get me copies. But while I was waiting for those scripts to arrive, I was imagining that, because of the size of the book, I was imagining that he had come up with four different, you know, kind of larger stories encapsulating the book. And I was fantasizing about all the things that Orson Welles came up with. And I was kind of astonished when the scripts arrived, and they were all very, very straight translations of the book. And I was kind of heartbroken, because I was like, oh man. And I realized that he was adapting the book before it became a phenomenon. You know, he was adapting just the story itself. And we had a very different task at hand. And but what was kind of crazy after that was I had all these fantasies about what he might have come up with. So he ended up inspiring a lot of the ideas that I ended up drawing upon to write those first few treatments, that when we started working as a larger team developing the story, some of those ideas that kind of were fantasies about what he would come up with ended up being really, really helpful. So he kind of got me over my block, my creative block, in a way. It's really bizarre when I look back at it.
Yeah, it helps you get over the block, but not quite in the way you were expecting.
No, and to say that Orson Welles helped me develop the story is just like, you know, it's ridiculous. But it was such an inspiration to know that he had also been sort of tackling the same like creative problem. Like, instead of going, oh, it's impossible, like he was really trying to find a way. So it helped quite a bit.
You know, well, yeah, adapting anything is difficult.
Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned that. I sometimes find, just in my own like small way, when I'm just having art blocks or something, that I'll look at some artist's work and they've been dead, you know, 100 years sometimes. But I sometimes feel that they're sort of like picking me up out of a ditch. And
yeah,
it's strange, the connection that you can feel to artists that you obviously never knew.
Was walking along the trail by my apartment, and like I'd hit one maybe every like 5-10 minutes, and I'm like, there should be more.
That's hilarious.
It's like,
it's crazy.
It's crazy. So you actually have to go out and walk, and it like,
yes.
I'm gonna get so skinny, it's not even funny. You basically, it tracks your location. Like, it, you have your little Pokemon on your phone, and it tracks your location on the map. And then Pokemon will pop up on your screen as you walk. Like, you have your little radar thing going off and stuff. And then once you get within range of a Pokemon you can catch, it'll pop up on your screen. And then you tap the Pokemon, and then it turns on this augmented reality. It's actually really cool. Mm-hmm. Where yeah. it looks like the Pokemon is there with you in your world.
Really, like, you... sitting in front of you.
Yeah, or sitting in front of you sometimes. Sometimes, randomly, once in a while, they'll show up in your apartment. I had a Bulbasaur show up on my coffee table the
other night. That's when my Charmander showed up, man. It was sitting right in my kitchen. I'm just like, dude, are you trying to nab a snack or what?
Anyways, I need to find a Charmander. Anyway, I had a Bulbasaur that showed up on my coffee table. So you fling Pokeballs at it until you catch it. And there's, like, I think there's some way you can time it or something. I'm still trying to figure that out. Because there's, like, a circle that slowly gets smaller, and I'm trying to figure out, do you fling when the circle's big or when it's small? I'm still trying to figure that out.
And then depending on where you are, like, we were talking, because I was talking to Mark about the VR stuff, and we're talking about AR stuff, too, and he pulled out that game. And I'm, like, too scared to put it on my phone right now. But depending on where you are, like, we were in the South Street Seaport, so we're by the water. So if you're, like, by the water, that also influences, like, what kind of Pokemon you can catch.
Yep.
Yeah, like, walking along this channel.
I got two Psyduck.
Yeah, I was walking along there, and I got a whole bunch of, like, whatever the crab one is called. It starts with a P. I can't remember it. I'm like, but I got a whole bunch of those. And then I'm like, on the other side is all this grass and park. So I got a bunch of grass type Pokemon, flying Pokemon.
Yeah, so it's like in Longwood Gardens, there's all, like, you know, there are ponds, there are fields of grass and stuff like that. And of course, by the flower beds, I found like two Oddishes. I'm like, that's too fitting.
I know. Yeah. So it's like actually out in the world getting Pokemon. And, like, it really encourages people to go outside because they don't often show up in your place and everything. Like, I've only had one show up in my apartment. So I actually have to go outside and actually, like, look for these stupid Pokemon. And then there's a gym right by my apartment, which now I have to. Like, I'm not kidding. Like, now I have my motivation to go outside on my days off. And I'm really excited. I want to go to Disneyland and see what Pokemon are there.
Oh my goodness, that's gonna be crazy.
That's the thing. Like, I wonder about, like, advertising. So I'm thinking, like GameStop. I guess there were some in GameStop. So I'm thinking, like, oh my gosh, like, you can imagine their companies paying to have Pokemon
put in.
Yeah.
You know, there's apparently one of the animators at Disney Features tweeted that apparently there's a gym inside the Disney Features animation building.
No.
Yeah, so he's like, good luck getting into that one. I'm really curious to see, like, what's at my hospital and everything, like,
they're public, like, didn't the, in Australia, wasn't there an announcement by the police station saying, mm-hmm. like, do not, you, there are no Pokemon here, or something like that, I don't know, like, you're not allowed to come in here with that.
Yeah, no, I was like, yeah, I'm gonna find out tomorrow, because, like, I go back to work tomorrow, and I was telling one of my coworkers, he's playing it too. It's so funny. And we're, like, going back and forth and everything. We're like these two, like, nurses in the ER, and here we are playing Pokemon Go, and we play Disney Tsum Tsum all the time too, and everything. We're like two big nerds, and, like, we do all this nerdy stuff together. Like, we've been to Disneyland with a big group, and, like, he got super drunk at California Adventure. Like, I had to get him hydrated. I'm like, I'm going to bring an IV start kit with me next time so I can bolus you with fluid, because, oh, my God, that was annoying. I was ready to punch him. He was acting like a five-year-old. We're trying to keep him in from Disney security so we don't get kicked out.
Disney security and Pokemon Go.
Yeah, seriously. So, yeah, no, he's going to find out what Pokemon are at our hospital, because he goes back today. So he's going to text me.
Please let it be, like, a Chansey or
I'm secretly hoping we have our own gym, okay?
That'd be sweet.
Right? Like, he and I were just like, that would be killer. And then we made sure we're on the same team, of course, for the gym. Mm-hmm. I think so. We're blue, team Mystic.
Sweet. Yeah, I'm a loner trainer right now. I haven't found anyone to play with yet, but I'm sure one day.
Oh yeah, my sisters play. Several of my friends play, and then my coworker. I knew he was going to pick it up and play too. Everything. I'm like, there's no way, and stuff. So I mean, we play all the stupid games together.
I wish I learned about this when I was in California, because then I could have like been running around Lake Tahoe, just like around the beach, just like throwing Pokeballs at things.
I know, right? It's what. Yeah, sorry, Chris. You got us off on like a huge, massive side topic and everything. Like that's your fault, because you're the one who asked us about it. So you know, you have no one to blame but yourself.
On the shorts, Christmas show, Marge's main, Homer's bro, Bardenwell, Flanders Fails, Whacking Snake, Monorail, Mr. Plow, Homer's face, Sideshow Bob, steps on rakes, Lisa's future, Selma's hubby, Marge not proud, Homer chubby, Homer worried, Bardis gay, Poochie, you two, NRA, Hippies, Vegas, and Japan, our couplets, and Marge boy band, Marge murmurs, Mort croaks, Lisa Buddhist, Homer talks, Peggy blows, burns away, what else do I have to say?
We'll never stop the Simpsons. Have no fears, we've got stories for years. Like Marge becomes a robot, maybe Mo gets a cell phone, as Bart ever owned a bear. Or how about a crazy wedding where something happens and do 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 do. Sorry for the clip show. Have no fears, we've got stories for years.
Hi, I'm back.
Hey!
Nice.
And no one else has gone either.
Yes. Okay.
Great.
Right?
Great.
Okay.
Let's not jinx it now.
Oh, yeah, I shouldn't have said that. I'm sorry.
I know, I was just like waiting for Dan to drop off.
It's always listening.